All right, we are here again to open the conversation to this episode, this next episode of Blind Faith. And we've got Salma, who's been with us a number of times, Salma Kettner.
Hello, everyone.
And we've got Josh Edwards, who's been recently joined the team. And he teaches some at Life Pacific and helps with students at the Student Success, the ASC.
Yeah, the okay. Academic Support Center.
I always forget what it is.
It's all right. That's why we're here.
I'm Andy Hopie. And so here in these points, I like to bring up some observations. I don't know why I'm laughing at that word. Observations about life and being blind. And so I was just in Helsinki, Finland for Pentecostal World Conference. And one time somebody was walking me. And I don't know why I don't remember who it was, but they were walking me down the stairs to my seat where I was. And they said, it's different here in Finland. People aren't moving out of the way. Do they not see your cane? And I was like, this cane's supposed to be an international symbol, but international doesn't always mean international, or maybe they just have a different way. And so I found out blindness interculturally is probably very different. But that reminded me of one of my favorite stories about how in the U.S. people do jump out of the way. My roommate in college loved to switch roles, and he'd give me his glasses, and then he'd hold my arm and my cane and then guide me from behind which way to go. And our favorites were at Disneyland because there's crowds of people. Yeah. And like we just, I didn't know, but he'd just aim me right into big crowds of people.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh.
And then like watch them jump out of the way.
Yeah.
One time though, we were at like a young adults group, something scavenger hunt in Old Town Pasadena, which is even older now, 25 years later. and we're walking around and then he did that. And one lady like jumped out of the way on the street and like fell down almost into the road.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my.
Yeah. And Salma, that's exactly the reaction that this other girl who had a crush on him had. And I think that's when her crush ended.
Heartbreaker, quite literally, huh?
Yeah. So sometimes playing around is fun, but I guess there's a limit. But it is interesting how like the cane is maybe seen a certain way in the U.S., but I don't know. I haven't done any research in Finland, but I guess somebody was telling me that people aren't moving out of the way, which is fine. I didn't really run into people, but it was just different in a crowd of 5,000 Pentecostals gathered at the Helsinki National Ice Hall, where the whatever popular team in Helsinki plays hockey. So that was that story. We'll just maybe now it's time to transition to we have Lisa Powell on the episode, so we'll get into the interview with Blind Faith, our podcast, which explores thoughts about God and life in this world. Our ethos is all scholarship is biography, so we'll hear some of her story and ask her some questions.
I was stuck in a labyrinth, called it a palace. He brought me out.
All right, we are so grateful to have Lisa Powell with us. I want to say Dr. Lisa Powell because it's often doctor does get used when men are introduced, but we forget to always say that when women have also earned that credential. So Lisa Powell is here, and I've been excited following her work when A Disabled God Revisited came out, and I ate that up in my dissertation research. And then have emailed with her a number of times, met her at AAR, the American Academy of Religion. I think that's what it is. But AAR, whatever that is. And then she teaches at St. Ambrose, trained at Princeton Theological Seminary, Bruce McCormick. I don't know if we'll talk about him or not. But Lisa has done a wonderful work and is just very kind and a gentle communicator. And I'm super excited to have her here. So welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yes, we're so excited to have you on the podcast today. And so kind of how we like to start our conversations is just asking, how did you get into disability theology? What was your journey? How did you find yourself in that space?
Sure. Well, getting into, this is an interesting question because obviously I get asked this a lot now.
Well, I also want to frame what I said in the email when I was talking to you. I loved your prologue or your like preface where you shared, even sharing your story as growing up Nazarene and then at a reform school, learning that maybe the song we also from a more holiness background love to sing, I Have Decided. And then your reform friend is like, are you sure you decided? So I just love how you gave a little of that backstory.
My acknowledgement section of my book is like the best part of my whole book.
That's a skill.
In the sense of like disability theology, you know, in part acknowledging how interdependent we are, the acknowledgments I tried to at least gesture toward how many people have, you know, formed and shaped and helped me throughout the process of writing, but also, you know, going back to being introduced to Reformed theology and how that impacted me when I was raised Nazarene. My dad was a Nazarene pastor until he retired. The like journey into disability theology, I think, is interesting because I was a pretty sick kid growing up, and it was only recently, as people have been asking me about how I got into disability theology, and I started to think about, well, I was hospitalized a bunch. I was constantly at like a, you know, prescription medicine regimen that I was on. I was come home at the lunch hour to take my breathing treatment. Didn't take PE through junior high because I had severe exercise-induced asthma. And so I just like worked in the library shelving books by myself when my friends were in, you know, PE class.
That could be my daughter. My daughter has really bad asthma and has had to like sit out a lot of time. So yeah, I can relate.
And you know, just like all of the pills set out before me at all three meals and breathing treatments before bed. And someone said, well, someone said to me at a conference recently, well, you had a medicalized childhood. And I was like, oh yeah, good. And I came from a family that, my dad played college basketball. My brother and my sister were both captain of their basketball teams in high school. And my brother went on to play college basketball.
Yeah.
And I always felt like this failure of a Powell, like it's like a big deal in the Powell family to be athletic. It's like what's prized. And I felt like just a failure, honestly, to my family, to my father, because I couldn't do any of that. But then, honestly, it wasn't until when I was in seminary, I through a sort of a much longer process, which we can talk about or not, but growing up in the holiness tradition and kind of having a bit of a faith crisis at a point in seminary, finding liberation theology as sort of a something I could hold on to and keep my faith and sort of get through this faith crisis that I was experiencing at the time and really became a student of theologies of liberation. And when I found out there was
a
disability theology of liberation, I had to get it. So
can I pause you there?
Yeah, yes, please.
First, theologies of liberation. I hear from some that they use the word liberation like it's a cudgel, and like there's one liberation theology, and it's not right. So maybe, and then I hear others who will respond to that and say, oh, you like domination theology? So liberation theologies, but you also said, and keeping, like it was a way to help keep your faith. And I think some in the circles where I've grown up are suspicious towards liberation theology because they see it as a way to lead you away from faith. So could you maybe unpack that a little bit more?
Ooh, okay. Yeah, well,
with whatever.
I'm gonna like whatever text,
whatever way you want to.
Details of holiness theology. I mean, you're Assemblies of God, right?
Foursquare, but similar. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
It's okay. Similar.
Okay. I mean, it's still it's a different denomination, but yeah. So I grew up in the Church of the Nazarene, took it very seriously, very devout. John Wesley taught something called Christian perfection. He had a whole book on Christian perfection. Oh, wow. And I took this idea that you could become so wholly sanctified. The Church of the Nazarene teaches something called entire sanctification, that you could become sort of almost like this, at least the way it was taught. And there's lots of debate in Nazarene circles about sanctification, what it means is, but entire sanctification, as it was taught at the day, at the time, you know, when I was growing up, was sort of this completed event. Like you get sanctified, your sinful nature is eradicated. This is the language they would use, so that you don't have a sin nature anymore. It is removed and you're entirely sanctified. And people in Nazarene circles would, like at camp meeting and so on, would talk about how like they hadn't sinned in 20 years, you know, which is funny because maybe that's the pride and, you know, yeah. But
I don't feel like I sinned in 20 years.
yeah. I was convinced, you know, that there's all these saints and people that were just completely consumed by love and passion for God. And I was desperate for that kind of purity and holiness. And it took a pretty, I don't know, unhealthy turn for me. I mean, I was practicing a lot of spiritual disciplines. I was fasting, not in like, didn't have a disordered eating situation, but trying to fast, you know, one day a week and doomed by it in graduate school. And then I was just weary of like not achieving it, you know? And, and one day I was crossing the street in Princeton and thought, it would be amazing if a car just hit me and I could just go be with Jesus now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I could just be united with my beloved, you know? And I was like, after that thought crossed my mind, I thought, oh, that's kind of messed up. Like that doesn't seem right. Like I shouldn't be wanting to die. Mm-hmm. And like, there was this missionary book that I was really influenced by, Amy Carmichael. Memoir is called A Chance to Die. You know, it's like that kind of mindset of like not living in the world, in the present, and answering the call that God has called us to in the world, but it became really internalized and it was about my personal holiness and my personal relationship with Jesus. Mm-hmm. So much so that I was obsessed in what became a pretty unhealthy fixation on my own personal holiness. And then to the point that I thought I could just die and it would be perfect because then I could be with Jesus.
Wow.
So that's when my faith started to crumble, when I when I was able to look at my thoughts sort of.
Yeah, right.
There's something wrong with that. So that's what led to what was my faith crisis, where I was like, whoa, this is really unhealthy. And I felt like what I had grown up learning was really dangerous and damaging to me. Mm-hmm. So when I say liberation theology saved my faith, it showed me this whole other aspect of, oh, I'm so sorry, Kit, my dog.
Oh, it's okay.
He likes to be in the room with me. And he will just keep scratching.
That's okay. There's others that have their dogs.
Story of how liberation theology, which directs your attention to, you know, God's work in the world and where Jesus is in the present, and not just trying to escape the world to be with Jesus in heaven, but realizing that Jesus is in our midst and Jesus is at work here and now. And obviously, liberation theology identifies Jesus at work with the poor and the oppressed and the marginalized, and you can find Jesus there instead of having to escape. And so, that's just a little glimpse at how liberation theology.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Jesus is in the present. Yeah.
And thank you for sharing that so much.
That was such a long
answer. It's helpful to us. Thank you.
Yeah, that was great. I loved how you talked about just like your story, how you kind of had a crisis of faith. I'm a university student right now, but I think that's honestly pretty common. I could see it more so in a graduate program, but even in an undergrad, it is kind of a little bit, it can be a little scary, I guess, to be studying theology and asking big faith questions. So I honestly was just encouraged by kind of your story and how even in the midst of just a crisis of the faith that you just continue to seek the Lord, and just even the fruit of that in the book that you've been able to write and just your work in disability theology.
Thanks. Well, I mean, the key, I guess, in how Reformed theology helped me in that was that it wasn't just about me seeking God, but God was seeking me. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No.
No, that's so good. Yeah.
But that's like the beauty of it, that I could rely on. Jeez, I didn't expect to get so emotional. Sorry.
It's okay.
It was a very tender story because it was obviously, but that's the beauty of it. That God doesn't give up on us.
And, that's so good.
And that's like the heart of, that's what, I mean, I grew up Wesleyan, but like that's that bit of the Reformed theology is like, God is faithful.
Yeah.
God's not going to abandon you. And that's, that proved to be true.
Yeah. That's so good.
I'm sorry. This is where I'm insensitive to your moment, but Reformed, like only if we're the elect. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. But like, yes, God is seeking us. God is after us. And so I'm just kidding.
I think God is after everyone.
Oh, wait. Yeah.
I don't embrace like a...
I know you're not referring to those.
You know, I don't get into that.
Neither do I. I just like to tease. I'm not that anti-reform. Okay, I'm sorry for making light of...
They just delisted us off a few sites now because of that comment.
Yeah, the disciples of John Piper are coming in after us. They're coming after us now. No, but you're so right that God is after us. And there's something beautifully, deeply emotional about that when we really understand that God is after us. And not because we have something special or because we are good enough for him, but... That side of the Reformed theology that talks about we have nothing to offer, but it's his grace alone. It's his unlimited grace. You know, we can use all the right theological terms, but it is a beautiful side of the Reformed theology that I think we lack in our Wesley holiness side of, I have decided and I have chosen you, God. So now you can work for me, God, and do the things I want to get done, which in Pentecostal circles, disability is so... misunderstood because it's like just heal the person, just fix the brokenness, and so like we have this magic genie that we know how to pray the right formula or just do this. And I've had so many people like say to me, oh, do you have enough faith, Andy? Like, I mean, a lot of people also say, oh, you have amazing faith, which is the other side of it, putting me on a pedestal. But others are like, oh, just have more faith. And only a few years ago was I even able to boldly say enough to the person, like, maybe you should have more faith. Like, maybe you need to pray harder. I'm praying hard enough. But we have this sense like we're in control of God on this free will side of things, which we can take too far. And I think we need the balance of free will and sovereignty. But I'm glad you shared your very vulnerable piece of that story.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Blind Faith. Now, a word from our sponsor. Are you ready to hear who's sponsoring this podcast?
Yes. Yeah.
Have you ever been to the Mall of America?
No.
Have you ever wanted to be the Mall of America?
No. Yes.
Oh.
Okay, one yes, one no. But what if I told you DeLeo Brothers Pizza? Okay.
I changed my answer.
One of the best pizzas in all of Minnesota, as voted by the people that vote for that. And here's their slogan. In garlic, we crust.
Oh.
Now you want to go to the Mall of America, don't you?
I'm going to the Mall of America right now.
Let's take a flight.
And they have a second location opening in Seattle. So look it up on this thing called Google. And DeLeo Brothers Pizza, bringing you Blind Faith Podcast. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now back to our regularly scheduled programming.
Although I had all of that experience of disability in my childhood, it wasn't until I taught Eslin's book.
Mm-hmm.
when I started working at St. Ambrose, in my liberation theology class, and even in my intro to systematics class, I taught her chapter on the Eucharist.
Can you, just because our audience won't know, Easland, mm-hmm. Nancy Easland, she wrote Disabled God, A Disabled God, A Liberatory...
The Disabled God.
The Disabled God. And kind of a master's thesis when she was at Emory, and really unpacked some reflections of her own experience. And so you were saying her chapter on Eucharist, maybe unpack that a little bit for our audience and then keep going where you're going.
Well, she, in her, so her book, The Disabled God, is supported by the fact that Jesus, primarily that Jesus had wounds that remained in his resurrected body, so that Jesus like ascended to heaven, took the wounds on his human body back to God to forever be sort of impaired in that sense. But she also supports her claim that God is disabled through Christ, in that in the Eucharist, in many traditions, not in memorialist traditions like we probably grew up in or are mm-hmm, still a part mm-hmm. of, Christ's body continues to be perpetually broken, so broken anew. So as a sign of Christ's sort of perpetually broken body, or that his broken body persists in the Eucharist. But then she talks about how excluded she was, and she got around in a wheelchair, how excluded she was from Eucharist because she wasn't welcomed in a lot of churches to roll down the aisle. They always wanted to bring her individually, the Eucharist, to her at her wherever she was located, mm-hmm. rather than mm-hmm. allowing her to right. join the procession wow. to the front of the church. And in some traditions, you literally kneel at the altar. In the Methodist church often, you, and in Episcopal churches often, you kneel at the altar at the front of the church. And so the experience of exclusion in Eucharist when a broken body should really be especially included, since it is the central symbol and like the central rite of the Christian faith. So I would have my students read that chapter and reflect on the broken body of Christ and our practices in the church. How do we treat people with disabilities and impairments in the church, in our liturgies and so on, and how mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. the broken body a part of our liturgy but still excluded or right. included?
Right.
Yeah.
So I taught that, and then I had a number of miscarriages. And it's when I had some miscarriages that I started reading beyond Easland, reading further in disability theology, because I was searching for theological resources that helped me deal with what felt like the failure of my body to do what I thought it could do or should do, or I, you know, deeply wanted it to do and sort of society expected it to do, or I always thought it would.
And maybe Hannah's song, we don't see that part of the story. Who knows how many miscarriages she had as she cries out to God, please let me. And so many of the narratives in scripture of the woman who is barren, and like,
right,
we don't really talk about that in our churches. It's like a thing that is okay. We talk about it as like, oh, there's something wrong. Wow. I could only imagine. I'm not somebody who could even walk in those shoes, but you must have been really wrestling with some things, looking for resources.
So that's what ended up. So I think the whole interview started with, how did you end up in disability theology? And I went all over the place.
And now we're out of time. No, just kidding.
Starting to research deeper in was, you know, I sort of recovered from all of my long problems and struggles from my youth and adolescence. And eventually it was really what it felt like the betrayal of my body through that drove me deeper into really just the rich gift of disability theology, to think about embodiment and what expectations we have of our bodies and society and religion, both obviously.
Wow.
Yeah.
Say more about that and religion.
Well, I mean, we're talking about miscarriages. Obviously, you know, I grew up in a religious tradition where, although we ordained women, the Church of the Nazarene ordained women since it became a denomination, I didn't see any women in leadership.
Oh, you mean it's just
growing up in the
church.
Yeah,
we see that all the time in the church. We have this on the books that we believe in it, but we don't practice it.
Women were, wanted, like, would go to college sometimes. You know, I went to Nazarene College. A lot of people felt a call to be a pastor's wife, to support their husband's ministry.
Right,
I
Salma?
I thought I was
going to
be a missionary. it was like, what are the options for women to serve God? And anyways, a lot of it revolved around motherhood. And
oh my goodness, yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, we have a lot of strange theologies in our religious Christian spaces, and a lot of it revolves around.
And it's reviving. I mean, there's this whole revival of
trad-wife?
Traditional trad-wife. Yeah,
trad-wife
movement. Yeah.
But I struggle with it too. My wife and I had trouble conceiving. I don't remember. Mm-hmm. I don't remember miscarriages, but so it was more. It was more me. So I was the problem, which then has all kinds of masculinity questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Toxic masculinity questions. Not like, I mean, I think Jesus wasn't worried about my masculinity, but this these things that messed with me emotionally.
Yeah.
And if I get too vulnerable and start crying, we can both have some moments on this spot. But it was really hard, and I suppressed it. Mm-hmm. My wife was like, why is this not bothering you like it is me? I'm like, I wish I could tell you why. I don't even know what emotions are. but this journey towards, like, and then we hear in our churches, be fruitful and multiply.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, don't we have 8 billion people in the world? How many more do we need?
How about we take care of the ones we have?
Okay, right. That
also.
Too. That too.
Feed the kids we have in the world for starters.
Right. Or like, how does that line up with Paul saying, don't get married? So like, how does
absolutely.
We read the scriptures according to what we want them to say and pick and choose when we want to use these scriptures. But yeah, I think we don't have a theology for singleness very well. We don't have a theology for barrenness. We don't have a theology for a number of things, but we do have certain simplistic commands that we love to preach a lot. So I don't know.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And it's crazy that how much I just said the word crazy, which is totally ableist of me. It's wild how it is, just really reviving in our culture right now. That sort of that idea of, oh, we're not having enough kids and we need to have more kids.
Well, we can go down the line and talk about certain tech, billionaires, I would love to ask. I would personally love to ask you. I know this isn't what the podcast is about, but I read these comments that certain unnamed people who are richest in the world want to procreate and want everybody to procreate, and then I read like in the Washington Post from the whatever section that is more for. How do I say it diplomatically, but the section that's written by women and for women and so on, like, why do I have to do something because you want me to, and the cost of, you know, raising a child and on it goes. And I'm like, I'd love to ask I ask my friends that are women, like, so how do you receive this when so-and-so says we need to have more kids, we're not having enough kids, which in some ways is code for me to have cheap labor, but or whatever. Or, or one woman tells me, it's because he wants to build an army to, you know, protect whatever interests he has. So I don't know. I don't know. But I'd love to hear your opinion on this whole, like,
feminism is supposed to say what we fight for is for women to have the choice to have kids and stay at home if that is what is their heart's desire. And hopefully, you know, they can financially afford to do that if that is their heart's desire. But for women to have the choice either way, so that one isn't necessarily better than the other. I mean, and I agree with that. I just want women to be able to follow the call and vocation and what fulfills them. Mm-hmm. And for some, that is to stay at home with their kids when their kids are young. And I get that. And that's one of the great things about my profession is that it has been very flexible. And I didn't produce a lot of research when my kids were young because I was at a teaching institution and they didn't push us to publish or perish sort of situation. And I was able to be home very early in the afternoon. And with in-laws around, we mostly had in-home care with family, which is an incredible privilege. But I was lucky to have a little bit of both. I mean, really, really fortunate to be able to spend lots of time with my kids when they were young, but also still eke out a little bit of a fulfilling career outside the home at the same time.
Yeah.
I don't know why it's sometimes put in this dichotomy of either or and all these things that we're all fighting
against each other. Like, you know, the stay-at-home moms hate the career woman and the career woman hates the stay-at-home mom. Like, I don't think it's that way. And it's certainly not that way among my friends, many of whom either are stay-at-home moms or work part-time.
We went on a little rabbit trail, but that's the way my mind works. So I want to, there are a couple of questions because your book was so, fruitful, stimulating, enriching, even at times provocative. And because Karl Barth is complicated and I'm so confused by the first two chapters that get into, you can say what you want. I'm fine. I'm just, there's some stuff I'd really love to talk about. I think it would be really helpful to understand a little more using Barthian Christology of Christ, you know, is submitted to the Father from, and you could explain it probably more simply right now, but I do want to get to some of the questions that you really address, especially coming towards out of your five chapters. The fourth chapter was so fascinating to me in the sense of the incarnation and some of the ways you talked about it in terms of how that could, putting on the flesh of humanness, is that a sense of like dominating yourself into like humanity, or is there a receiving? What's the reciprocity or receptivity piece to that puzzle? And just unpack that a little bit about how that helped take the question of a disabled God into the place of even the incarnation.
Sure. As I mentioned, Easlin primarily rests her argument on Jesus's wounds and reads his wounds as being a sign of impairment. And some people think that's not enough to be disabled, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I
argued with somebody the other day on Facebook, you know, the best place or text message or text message, like, no, it was Facebook. Like, yeah, but the lamb that was like that picture in Revelation 4, he looks pretty disabled at that point. Like, yeah. So I don't know, but there could be disability in heaven. We'll get to heaven in a minute, but cool.
Can I ask a clarifying question just so I can keep the conversation a little bit?
His homework. He didn't know we were doing.
Yeah, I got here and he's like, hey, you want to be on a podcast? I said, yeah, sure. I'll hang out for a little bit. So the idea you said of disability, it seemed like there's a spectrum. What would be like the ends to that spectrum for scholars? One scholar would say this or that. Like,
well,
what
this
would
is really, this is much debated in disability studies because Andy can obviously also speak to this, but there's such a range of different disabilities. My daughter has multiple learning disabilities. She has dyslexia, dysgraphia, and ADHD. She has accommodations. She has an IEP at school. You know, how disabled is she really socially? Is she stigmatized? I don't know. And then there's people that maybe have chronic illness who go in and out of symptoms. Mm-hmm. Is that a disability? Mm-hmm. And then there's people who are caregivers for people with disabilities and parents of children with significant disabilities. And they closely identify with the disability community because they live it
Yeah.
All day long and are advocating for policies and legislation and for care and for support. So are they included in the disability community? So there is a lot of debate about the range, you know, autism spectrum, obviously physical disabilities, intellectual disabilities, mental illness or mental challenges. How do we include that in the disability discussion? How much is that? And it can be quite disabling. So, so it's debated and it's not, there's no clear cut, line. Yeah.
Okay.
And I can say more, but I'm, this is for us to listen to you. And I think that really helps us a lot. So thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now I want to hear what Andy thinks. Oh, what is your response?
I had to write a whole like literature review on what is disability.
I bet.
So there was a like, I lean more towards those that include chronic illness, disabling conditions, so on, because there is a social aspect, there is the impairment aspect, but there's also the lived embodied aspect. I really, some might not like that, but I really like the critical disability studies and those that build off of Foucault and so on. Margaret Childrick, and I forget some of the other names that I read, but really the embodied experience, and that's going to look different for everybody, but we all are differently, inhabit the world differently. And so that helps us understand that humanity isn't a one size fits all.
Right.
And so I'm very troubled right now because when we cut the Department of Education, who's the first to be wrecked by those decisions, those with disabilities? When we changed the Librarian of Congress to, I won't even get into that too much, but then who's getting hurt? Those that have access to the library with books in Braille and audiobooks and all the different.
Yeah.
So these things are very meaningful to me. And I'd rather have a wider net for who needs help than a more narrow net, narrow list. So that's where I probably fall.
Yeah, I agree. My daughter mostly learns through audible formats. So she's an auditory learner. Yeah. So I agree.
So I think we were talking about the idea that you were moving beyond Nancy Easland and to drawing out some of the other like more like central ideas of who is Christology and how do we maybe see disability even in some of those things like the incarnation.
Right. Okay. So, and this is here in this chapter at the beginning, I borrow from Bruce McCormick's interpretation of Kannada Christology and how he spins this ancient or patristic theologian Cyril of Alexandria, who saw sort of this self-emptying of Philippians 2, the hymn, the Kannadic hymn of Christ emptied himself. Christ emptied himself. Oh, I should have looked that up.
Oh, it's okay.
But it's not, Philippians, not, Philippians not considering 2. Himself equal to God.
Yeah, right. Philippians 2. Yeah, it's.
Yeah,
and the kenosis, the emptying of Christ, emptying himself, taking on flesh. And so Bruce McCormick was going with that a certain way.
Yeah. And instead of seeing so it's usually the idea is that Christ empties himself of usually the omnis, like omnipresence, omnipotence, omniscience, like that Jesus sets the Christ or the Son sets those aside and doesn't use those powers or, you know, knowledge when embodied. But then the assumption is often that he just reassumes them when he ascends into heaven and is now omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient. But instead of thinking of it as an emptying, because it's a humbling, it's like humbled himself, not considering equality with God, something to be grasped. It's an addition of humanity. So it's the addition, the placing of humanity into union with divine and human in union together is humbling for the divine. So the humbling is the addition. So rather than an emptying or a setting aside, it's it's the addition of the humanity. And so McCormick talks about the son's identity as being eternally receptive, eternally prepared to receive and to receive the humanity. And so that in Christ, the humanity is the real agent of the God-human unity that is Jesus. And so thinking about the divine as being receptive rather than, so when Cyril of Alexandria describes this, of course, it's really more like the divine uses the humanity, you know, like a puppet, a flesh, you know, like an instrumentalizing of the humanity. You is in total control, and it's really the son that is the total agent, and the humanity becomes negligible at that point. How human is that, really a humanity like we are human?
Nope.
Right. And so I try to think about sort of, and then this is honestly a bit of a controversial way of thinking about disability, and rightfully so. It's just one proposal out there. But, you know, not always wanting to equate disability with receptivity or vulnerability. So trying to think about this with the way that God works in the incarnation in a way that sort of models an interdependency and a receptivity and a giving and a receiving. And so that's sort of where I take that idea in. And I have to get into a bunch of weird Bartian stuff because Bart has a very patriarchal interpretation of the father-son relationship, where he actually calls, you know, he says the father commands and the son obeys, the father leads and the son submits. And he likens it to the relationship between a husband and wife.
Yeah, and we have all kinds of...
Oh, it's not a subordinationist. They're still equal because they both have roles that need to be filled in order for them to fulfill their sort of their purpose. But it's obviously, you know, that's not... Personally,
how does that feel to you, Salma? That you just are a wife, you just obey what the husband says.
It's interesting to hear.
Yeah, I mean, we have some that take this, you know, in some circles to eternal subordination of the son,
and
which is like, oh, wait, that's not even, it's almost heretical. Are we allowed to say heretical? But
And Bart gets called a subordinationist, and he tries really, really hard to prove that he's not a subordinationist. But it's, you know, he has to work hard to try to argue that, because it sure sounds like it. Yeah.
Well,
is a heresy. Yeah.
He's written thousands of pages. I'm sure he's able to explain himself, but
he's claimed it many times.
But I mean, there's a lot that we can like about Bart. There's some interesting things about Bart too that we maybe don't have to agree with. But I think I think the thing that was interesting to me, and so as I have a disability, quote unquote, blindness, I was attracted to that chapter. I don't know if I'm right or wrong when it comes to disability and vulnerability and how I talk about it, but I think disability allows us to understand the mystery of humanity, the mystery of creation and the creator, because we all have some kind of limits, brokenness, because we are not perfected beings. And then that's the question of, well, would there have been disability? Yeah, maybe. I mean, God says he created the blind and the deaf, the mute. He says that. So what do we do with that? Yeah. But does it, like, I understand the impulse towards disability. There's nothing wrong. We're all we're all strong in a certain way. I understand the impulse, but I also appreciate feminist philosophy, and you quote Eva Kitte. And so that got me running down that trail of ultimate independence is impoverishment. And I think I've made that quote in other episodes, but like that idea that autonomy is not the goal. And I think independent living and that movement with disability made that the goal. Let's get you to a place where you can live on your own. Okay, now I live by myself and I have no friends. And and so, I mean, I learned how to do that, but it was for me, who's social and very outgoing, it was utterly sad to just know how to live by myself.
Yeah.
And so,
isolating.
So I think there was something really intriguing about your proposal, as well as the idea of interdependence. To me, I think disability helps us realize we are all interdependent one way or another. And not to flatten that everybody's disabled, but as humans, we all are interdependent. And so some people have different ways of embodying that. But so I found it very intriguing. Maybe I'm wrong. I've only been at this for a few years, but I've lived it for a while. So I was intrigued. I was intrigued by that idea of vulnerability. And you draw out the way that Bart may have the patriarchy side of where that can lead to some destructive ideas I'm not going to remember how well you articulate it, but I read it over a year ago, but the idea that somehow God is dominating human flesh by, you know, taking on flesh as a utilitarian or instrumentalizing it. And I think that incarnation is a beautiful thing of what Jesus did to take on flesh, to receive flesh. It put limits, or he allowed there to be limits. I don't know that he set aside the omnis. I'm not a theologian in that way that I've even realized. I just don't think he did. I do think things of questions of impassibility are certainly still there. Did he suffer on? I don't know that he just put that aside and nope, I don't suffer because I'm divine. So I think Jesus, in taking on flesh, allowed himself to feel the limitations of humanity, whether or not it's disabled in the explicit sense of he walked around with a limp or socially was ostracized like maybe not, but as far as where he was to in the otherworldliness of heaven to then coming into this world, I mean, he certainly, in terms of the economy of the Trinity, was disabled. So I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of room to even go further than where you went. I mean, it was one chapter. I'm not saying you didn't do enough, but there's ways to keep exploring it. And so, I mean, maybe just draw out a little more what you did to criticize Karl Barth. And that's a bold thing to do on how that could lead to patriarchy and this idea of, human taking on humanity as not just the receptivity of it, but like that you're, you said it much more articulately. So I'm trying to pass it back to you.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think what's so beautiful about McCormick's interpretation of Bart, and I do sort of push beyond McCormick, certainly, but it's this idea. I mean, I think it challenges the ableism that's behind so much of our theology, that God has to be all powerful, because we just assume that sovereignty and self-sufficiency is of ultimate value, right? That is like God is God because God is self-sufficient and because God is all powerful. And instead, what I argue in the book is that God has chosen from the very original moment of God's triunity to need. And that suggests that kind of self-sufficiency just isn't an ultimate value for God. It's so unimportant that God has chosen from eternity to not be that being. God, that vulnerability and life together and sort of reciprocity and life together and interdependence is of a much more supreme value than is self-sufficiency. Yeah. And God modeled that for us in the incarnation. And it really challenges this idea of, for God to be God, God has to be this sort of sheer power, sheer force who could destroy everything in a second if God wanted to. Like, that's what makes God God. But I think instead what we see is, what makes God God is that God, I mean, yes, God is, that's where I don't quite go far enough, maybe not radical enough, because I do say that God chose this, that God chose to be this kind of God eternally from the very primordial moment of God's self-determination. But always, there's never a God behind a God who has chosen to be in relationship with that which is not God. God's very being sort of relies upon relationship, and not just internal relationship with the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, but actually external relationship with creation. And so God relied upon Mary, God relied upon the humanity of Jesus to bring this covenant into fulfillment and to, you know, bring this relationship into ultimate perfection, which will be experienced in the resurrection.
Wow.
Well, I think it's an enriching and maybe perplexing in the right kind of way, as you bring out so many wonderful quotes from a number of people. I really liked what you brought out from Shane Clifton and Sean mm-hmm. Copeland and some others. I forget who it was, if it was Luke Powery or who it was with even African-American preaching and so on. And there was a number of things that I want to just point people to go read it, chapter 4 from your okay. work. But for the last few minutes, if we could have just a little reflection on life ever after. Seems like there's a number of ways that people address disability in terms of heaven. And mm-hmm. and I personally wrestle with that, because what is a perfected body? Mm-hmm. Okay, when was it when I was 19 before I lost my eyesight? And mm-hmm. well, I wasn't quite as strong as I was at 23 or 20, or I wasn't certainly as wise as I was at 45. Mm-hmm. What's a perfected body? Yeah. And, mm-hmm. And so I think you did some interesting things when you came to chapter 5 and talking about heaven.
Well, I mean, this is the most contested topic within disability theology. I mean, it has been really hotly debated.
Well, you were brave to jump into it.
I don't think I knew how contested it was when my fifth chapter was an article before it became a part of the book. But certainly I was influenced by Amos Young, sure. and I think you had him on the podcast already.
Yeah. Yeah. We didn't ask that question. So
We had Debbie Kramer,
and we didn't ask her that question either. But I loved your chapter, so that's what I was with. I was with saving it for you.
Oh, thanks. I think the main argument I make is that ableist identity dissolves. So it's not, I know I say that the duality or the binary of able and disabled disappears, but it's not because necessarily disability disappears, but because sort of able-bodiedness as self-sufficiency, independence disappears. Because what I argue is that we become more and more like Christ. And as Christ was dependent, the Son was independent, right? And embodied this mm-hmm, sort of model mm-hmm. of receptivity.
Yeah.
That we too enter into this truly enriching interdependent life where we are ever giving and receiving gifts. So we are receiving from another and we are giving to another. And so in that sense, in that we are losing that self-sufficiency and independence, the able-bodied identity dissolves in the eschaton.
Yeah, and I think that answers the question sufficiently enough for here, but mm-hmm. maybe to take it to step B is, okay, so you wrote this chapter, you wrote an essay before the chapter, you found that it's a contested and viscerally contested.
Yeah.
Because I have people who are like, well, I don't want any remnants of schizophrenia in heaven.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, no, I think the Revelation story says no more tears, no more cry. Those mm-hmm. things that we don't want won't be there. But does it mean it will look exactly like we imagine in this Disneyland picture of the happiest place in the world, that nothing, bad will be there. So that means I will have my eyesight again. I will have this again, I don't want to name names, but people who can test, they won't have a wheelchair in heaven. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's visceral. It's almost mm-hmm. I've had people say they're concerned about my theology when I'm just asking a question about what will it be like in heaven. I don't really mm-hmm. even know, because I think it's much more a mystery, yeah. but Right. So what would you maybe say even more nuanced based on the feedback you've gotten, or are you still kind of resting in the way that you've way that you've come to it?
Well, I mean, I think I've been misread a little bit, because people have claimed that I say that disability doesn't exist, which isn't obviously what I say, since I say able-bodiedness.
Yeah, I didn't read it that way.
Yeah, so you know, there's, you know, we have people writing book reviews, read it fast and maybe skim the last chapter.
Well, they're reading. Some people read to critique, and they're not even reading to learn. They don't first read to learn, so they're just looking for something to say. Oh, you didn't say this like I wanted you to.
I mean, I think I still, you know, we have this image of, I mean, probably thanks to Augustine, of heaven as this return to the Garden of Eden, and people imagine the Garden of Eden as this place of perfection, and then we get into this whole realm of like, disability would never have existed if not for sin. And so I think if you say that disability utterly is erased, you sort of are relying on that narrative of impairment is tied to sin, which is really damaging.
Yeah, right, right.
So I definitely don't want to go the route of, I just don't think, I mean, if the point of heaven is to be in loving communion with each other, and like you said, not just like a Disneyland where we're just where the point is just running around, like getting, like my students sometimes, it's like I can get whatever ice cream I want whenever I want, you know, it's like,
yeah, I'm like, an adult now. I'm an adult now, I can get ice cream all day long.
If it's really about living and, you know, eternally in awe of God and in loving communion with God and each other, then I don't know how much those things matter, except that they do matter in the present and how we think about what heaven is like. And if people's identities are erased in heaven, what does that say about how we view their bodies and minds in the present? And so I think I have to be careful about, I mean, and every disability theorist would tell you this, I'm not, you know, unique in saying that, but how we think about the future
affects
really
how
does
we
impact
think about
what we value now.
So, okay, I feel like we did a lot today. We criticized Karl Barth and we criticized Augustine, and Augustine dominated theology in Europe from 500 to 1500. So we've done a lot today.
We covered some territory. We also critiqued Wesley's Doctrine of Perfection a little bit, I think.
Oh my gosh. And
I cried. I mean, boy. Here,
a little advertisement, truth in advertising. I work with the Center for Pentecostal Studies here at Life Pacific, and we are helping partner with this Wesley Holiness Connection that's being hosted at Life Pacific October 2nd. So we've got presidents of denominations coming on campus for, president of Asbury, you mentioned Asbury, David Watson's coming over, and I'll point them to this podcast so they can.
Okay. I mean, I Wesleyanism is still a big part of my formation, and I haven't abandoned it entirely. I still have a soft spot.
It almost
killed me, but you know.
Not everything in it is wrong. If we take if we take it to the extreme, there's ways that it falls short. That's why we need to have theology and conversation.
Yeah,
I totally agree.
Salma or Josh, do you have any questions that have been sparked on these things as we come towards the end?
I mean, honestly, I feel like it's just been great just to listen and to hear some really smart people talk about some really cool topics. So thank you. Thank you for being with us today and just for sharing all of your knowledge with us.
Yeah, I'm quite ignorant to all this, so it was really nice for me to get thrown onto this last minute, but I also
you and I co-wrote an essay for Stephen's book on spirit in the sketch or whatever about
visuality
and disability. Yeah.
That was going to be, this was a toss up. That was the dime, you know, it's to advertise that too.
I mean, a theologian over here, Lisa, might be interested in pneumatology and these books that Stephen's got going on about spirit and art. But anyway, he invited me to write an essay. I'm like, I need help. I'm working at a school that keeps me busy. I don't have time to write an essay. Yeah. So he gives me Josh.
And so then, here's a junior scholar to do it for you.
Josh is here to co-write with you. Yeah. And at the end, all of Josh's part was edited out. And
I got some parts in there. It's okay. My discipline's in kind of just history in general. So I added some history in the beginning. And they're like, yeah, it's not real pertinent to what we're doing. I was like, okay, well, I'll help edit. But that's not like a pity thing. It's just kind of what took place. But it reminded me of two things, I think, just kind of listening the whole time. And then if there's an idea you want to riff off, feel free. It was the concept of this idea of, and just kind of in my studies recently too, just kind of really understanding, you know, if Christ made us, and this idea of the Logos, and just how Greco-Roman, ancient Near Eastern thinks of, like, you know, like the Ruha of Yahweh, and just like how Yahweh so intimately sustains people in life and creation. And just kind of reminded me some of what you were talking about today, just kind of like going back to that, I guess, Hebrew kind of theological emphasis of like that God sustains, you know, there's an interconnectedness. And then we were trashing Augustine and then I'm doing a little paper. I'm researching his pneumatology because I'm a Pentecostal, so I have to find the spirit and everything. Yes. And so I was looking at that, and even this idea of how this, you know, and I'm not saying this is the way, but in how he was describing the spirit being of the love and the means of communing, were like the communio, I think. I could barely speak English, so I'm having fun with Latin words sometimes. I guess it just kind of is, as I've been studying that, it's kind of cool to hear how you've been talking about it. And this is kind of like our generational contextualization of these things that we see in scripture and that we've been talking about in church, you know, history and things and different phrases. And I think for me as a historian, it's really interesting to kind of hear everything that's being talked about here and then putting in conversation with things, you know, historically. And then it's just interesting as a historian to see, oh, yeah, that makes sense why that person wrote that in history. But then how we take this one person's statement and go, oh, this is the same as Jesus, you know, and you're like, whoa, okay, well, Jesus is Jesus. This person's a person trying to make sense of their faith and understanding in their context, you know. And like we were saying here, theology should be a dialogue, you know? And I think this is interesting. We have, you know, almost treating historical theology like that, like more as a dialogue, but, you know, people sometimes take that and champion it and stuff like that, and it becomes something else than it
decontextualize it. Yeah. Right. Yep.
So thank you. That's a long-winded way of saying thank you. I really appreciate it today.
Thank you. I've actually been reading a lot in Bart about his doctrine of creation and and you're right, Yahweh as sustainer of creation. And I read everything I could find that he wrote about God and the flood. And he talks a lot about how, you know, God chose to continue to sustain it.
Wow.
Repented of God's repentance. And it was, I don't know, it's a fun new topic as I move into my next research. So,
yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. I have to call it now, even though I have more questions.
I'm so sorry for all the
technical has to run.
I do.
Part two in the future.
But thank you so much for being with us. This has been a joy. So that was a lot and interesting. I was really glad we did that.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool just to hear her story. I feel like I say that with every single podcast I've recorded, is just to hear the story and just to hear from someone who really has, you know, researched, studied, but you can really tell that she, that it's been a journey to her discovering what her theology is, and especially even her journey to getting into disability theology. That was really cool to hear her story.
Yeah, I like the idea of, like, for me, like, when I'm looking at people when they're speaking in history, it's kind of just like, what is their story? What is their context and how they construct it? And it seems she had this kind of theme of everything in her life told her she had to be like this. And we live in a society where what you do matters, your skills, you're supposed to be, you know, some sort of, sometimes literally an object, right? Like, this is what you should be. And then we live our lives and realize we were not that. And society and sadly the church doesn't help us sometimes realize, no, that's not what we're supposed to be like. We're supposed to be like Jesus. And who did Jesus make you to be? And how is Jesus's grace covering what needs to be, you know?
Yeah.
And it's kind of cool that there's almost this rediscovering of the gospel she found through kind of this vein of theology, you know, and kind of not only just these are my ideas, I'm going to build my life and career off it. But like, I encountered Jesus in this way so strongly, I want other people to feel reprieve and know Jesus the way how he encountered me. You know, it's almost kind of like this, I don't know, Martin Luther-esque kind of story, not trying to say, yeah, that's the guy to follow, but just this idea that he was so convinced by this thing that it drove him to be, I'm going to, you know, rebel against every single power that tells me besides the experience I have with Jesus, which we can critique and say is good or bad, right? But yeah, just being so consumed by this experience with Jesus that it drives you then to find, you just see the fruits of the Spirit emanate from that, you know, and I think that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I certainly loved that she was able to just share her story and let it come up so transparently and vulnerably. And then I thought I made her mad and she hung up on us, but we lost her signal or whatever and it took a few minutes, which nobody will know
and
as
then
we
you repented.
Edit this together. But it was like, oh no, we were having a great time and I wrecked it. but we were able to get her back connected and really have some fascinating reflections on the incarnation, on the eschaton. I mean, canonic hymns and words that I don't usually say, but the kenosis and these things. I think we had some really interesting reflections, and I hope it just mainly, I hope it provokes people to think more carefully, because it's so easy to be certain heaven's going to be this
way. Or even like slow down. Like, hey, let's invite everybody to the conversation. Like that thing we said when we were writing the chapter, and it was this idea of slowing down that everybody's able to be in participation.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, that's important.
That's good.
But now we have to slow down enough that people can go listen to something else or move on to the next.
Or go to episode 10.
Oh, that'll come in a little bit. we've been having a great time doing this, and and we brought Josh Edwards into it, and so he'll jump in here or there. Who knows? But
we'll find out through the comments.
Thanks. we're having fun. We're learning. This first year has been a great joy for me as I'm learning how to do this thing of podcasting, but also asking questions, curious, and so I've been also super loving doing it with people. So
it's been
we'll keep doing it, and see you guys next time on the podcast. This has been another episode of Blind Faith, and we'll see you next time. This has been another episode of Blind Faith. Enjoy having you with us, and come stick around. If you like this one, give us a click like, and whatever platform you're on, give us a rating, and go ahead and subscribe. We're glad you're here with us. We'll be with you again soon.